which will soon be independent. The Western Sahara turned out to be such a bone of contention that a special meeting was devoted to it. Kenya was fiercely criticized by countries which believed that this country had cooperated with Israel in the operation to rescue Jewish hostages of the Air France Airbus in Uganda. Libya and Sudan, finally, again at loggerheads following the abortive coup in Sudan last week. A number of countries in North Africa and the Middle East have started a press campaign against Libya following charges that that country was involved in the abortive coup in Sudan late last week. According to Sudan, at least 100 men from various African countries had been trained in Libya to murder President Numeri. Egypt and Tunisia say that Libya is hatching more plans like this. Libya denies having been involved in any way in the event in Sudan in which, according to President Numeri, many people were killed. Following new fighting in Lebanon, the Arab League has, for the time being, abandoned its attempt to arrive at another ceasefire. The battles between the Lebanese and Palestinian factions focus on the Christian village of Cheka, south of Tripoli, and the Palestinian camp Tal Zatar near Beirut. The fighting has claimed a record casualty rate. An Arab League representative is trying to bring the warring factions together, primarily to talk about a truce. Left-wing leaders in Lebanon have repeatedly said that such a truce can be realized only when the Palestinian camp is taken by Christian militiamen who have conquered most of the camp. But the defenders, who have been under siege for weeks, are still offering fierce resistance. Taiwan is firmly determined to take part in the Montreal Olympics as the Republic of China. Canada objects because it feels that China should be represented by teams from the Chinese People's Republic. The chairman of the International Olympic Committee, Lord Kilanen, feels that Canada's position seriously endangers the future of the Games. Taiwan itself is of the opinion that as a member of the IOC, it has the right to take part under the name of Republic of China. The Olympic Games also received political attention at the African summit in Mauritius. The Organization of African Unity has called for a boycott by all African countries if New Zealand should participate. This follows African protests over a tour by a New Zealand rugby team of South Africa. Spain's new Prime Minister, Adolfo Suarez Gonzalez, is facing mounting difficulties in his attempts to form a new government. The composition of that government will largely decide the attitude of the Spanish opposition towards him. At least six ministers serving in the outgoing government of Prime Minister Arias Navarro refused to stay on under Suarez. Among them are the Interior Minister, Fraga, who's known as a progressive, and the Foreign Minister, Villarreal. Prime Minister Suarez made a political career within the National Movement, the only political group allowed under the Franco regime. It's expected that the new Prime Minister will pursue a policy of gradual reforms. He will probably recruit most of his ministers from the Catholic lay movement, Opus Dei, to which many technocrats belong who have no pronounced political ideas. And as Holland is going to export less natural gas in the next few years, Iran wants to adopt the role of the natural gas supplier of Western Europe. Holland wants to stop exporting gas within 20 years. Apart from Iran, more oil-producing countries want to export gas that at present they burn at their oil fields. Within the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, the possibilities are being studied aside from price arrangements for oil, also to set up cartels for natural gas. Well, that's the news. Now with more of News Block, here is Roger Bannon. Hello again. There are roughly three strategies with which to answer threats of violence on the part of hijackers. One can meet their demands to buy freedom for the hostages. One can negotiate at length, wear them out psychologically in a war of nerves. And one can use violence. This last strategy is no doubt the most risky of the three. Gaining time carries an element of risk too, since there's no telling what hijackers may do when they become nervous or aggressive. Meeting demands, especially financial ones, must be the safest way, although this incurs long-term risks. The risk of repetition, for instance. Well,
the Israelis chose the third alternative.
In the commando action at Entebbe Airport, 103 people were freed.
The death toll includes 20 of them,
7 hijackers, 3 hostages, and 1 Israeli soldier.
A total of 31.
The ratio of dead to rescued is 1 in 3.
Now, ethics is not mere arithmetic. One cannot categorically say that one human life is worth the freedom of 3 people. It follows that the Israeli raid was not an act of humanitarianism. It's based on a wider, more general sort of arithmetic.
The train of thought of the Israeli government is easily followed. Israel is in a permanent state of war. Human life is of secondary importance. The end result is what counts. Anti-Israeli hijackings are an integral part of the state of war.
To give in is akin to losing on the battlefield.
Successful hijackings encourage further action. If Israel had given in and released a substantial number of Palestinian prisoners, the encouraging effect would be greater still. It would mean, actually, that hijackers don't really run risk. If their action fails and they are arrested, a future hijacking has to obtain the release. In carrying out the raid at Entebbe, the Israelis took enormous risks.
The whole thing could easily have ended in a massacre with few or no survivors.
In the final analysis, the decision to act was founded on 2 considerations. On the one hand, a firm belief in the courage and skill of the Israeli commandos.
And on the other, the devout wish to inflict a crushing defeat on the army of international hijackers.
Humanitarianism had nothing to do with it, nor did international law.
Israel has chosen to fight fire with fire.
In the West and West,
the Netherlands included,
there's widespread admiration for the swift and effective Israeli action, as well as satisfaction over the defeat of the hijackers.
It's only natural that
from the beginning, public sympathy was on the side of the hostages, and that the Israeli action was greeted with approval and relief, particularly because it had been successful.
But all this doesn't alter the fact that, from a point of international law, a few questions can be raised.
Formally, the Israeli operation was a violation of Uganda's sovereignty.
The fact that this country has a regime which enjoys little international respect is beside the point.
The raid took place in a country that is not at war with Israel. It resulted in the destruction of Ugandan jet fighters at Entebbe Airport and in the death of 20 Ugandan soldiers.
International law recognizes situations in which such action is permitted or at least justifiable. It recognizes a country's duty to protect its citizens in other countries if they're in serious danger and if the government of the host country is unable or unwilling to afford them adequate protection. A situation must exist which cannot be resolved by negotiation or diplomacy. And Israel claims that just such an emergency situation did indeed exist. It says that the Ugandan government did nothing to save the lives of the hostages, that in fact it cooperated with the hijackers and thus became an accomplice to an act of terrorism. President Amin denies this and claims instead that the Ugandan authorities did everything to solve the matter peacefully through negotiation with the hijackers. No military action was taken to overpower the hijackers, but Uganda claims that would have endangered the lives of the hostages, and it wasn't up to us to make that sort of decision. Israel, if that country was prepared to take such grave risks, should have submitted a plan for the operation to us. It's understandable that Israel had absolutely no confidence in General Amin and decided to act on its own. Its claim that an emergency situation existed seems defensible, although this could never justify the destruction of Ugandan jet fighters, a move which was probably designed to prevent pursuit of the Israeli planes by the Ugandan Air Force. From the point of international law, a few moot points remain. Nevertheless, it seems unlikely that the United Nations Security Council will sanction Israel for its action. United States President Ford has congratulated the Israelis on their successful operation. So it may reasonably be assumed that any Security Council attempt at censuring Israel will meet with a firm American veto. There can be no doubt that Kenya was informed about the Israeli raid of Entebbe and even cooperated with it.
The Israeli transport planes made a refueling stop in Nairobi.
Medical facilities for the treatment of possible casualties were set up there, and eventually a number of wounded were hospitalized in Nairobi. Surprisingly, Uganda's African neighbor came out quite openly and admitted that Kenya had been involved in the action.
The Nairobi newspaper The Nation launched a sharp attack on President Amin, saying that he had welcomed the hijackers with open arms.
The East African Standard went even further, saying that Israel had taught Africa a well-deserved lesson by shattering the myth of its invincibility. So far, Israel's unpredictability has become a byword, has reacted calmly to Kenya's complicity. He said on Sunday that he was willing to forgive the Kenyan people this dirty trick. The recent events will certainly lead to a deterioration in Kenyan-Ugandan relations, which have anyway been strained for months. A few months ago, Amin made certain claims on Kenyan territory, although he agreed later not to curb them, and not so long ago, Ugandan troops carried out raids in a few Kenyan border villages. Kenya is afraid of Amin's regime, and not without reason. From a military point of view, Kenya is much weaker than its neighbors, especially Uganda and Somalia. The Kenyan army is made up of more than 6,500 ill-equipped troops. The aircraft consists of 14 old-fashioned planes. Uganda and Somalia have for a considerable time been receiving military aid from the Soviet Union, and their armies each consist of 20,000 volunteers. The Ugandan Air Force boasted 46 fighter planes, including 40 Soviet-made mid-jet planes. Between 6 and 10 were wrecked last Sunday at Entebbe Airport, no doubt much to Kenyan satisfaction. Uganda has not been able yet to train enough pilots to fly the MiG fighters, and Israeli forces claim Amin has enlisted Palestinian pilots for this purpose. Kenya is currently bringing its armed forces up to the mark, and is looking to the United States for support. 10 Northrop jet fighters have already been ordered. But if there were to be a military conflict between Kenya and Uganda now, Kenya would almost certainly be the loser.
Well, so much for the Israeli commando action at Entebbe Airport in Uganda. We move now to Spain, where on Monday afternoon, Adolfo Suarez Gonzalez was officially installed as the new Prime Minister during a brief ceremony at the Royal Palace in Madrid. Now, political attention centers on the formation of a new cabinet. And as our Barcelona correspondent Robert Bosshat reports, speculation is rife.
The young candidate new Prime Minister, who voted his age, had a long meeting Sunday evening, but nothing has been confirmed about their decision. It seems, however, that the new cabinet will be composed by the classic conservatives and some of the technocrats of the Opus Dei, a Catholic organization, who already dominated the Spanish government in the 60s. This certainly does not attract the liberals, and of course even less the democratic opposition. The two most young liberals of the former cabinet, José María de Arenza, Foreign Affairs, and Fraga Iribarne, Interior, explained that they would refuse to participate in the government if Suarez would try to get the Opus Dei technocrats to come back. Also, there is also the liberal minister for information, Martín Gamero, is of the same opinion. It would certainly be significant if Arauza, a confidant of the king, would leave government. It could be taken to mean that King Juan Carlos finally was unable to maintain control over the cabinet crisis after having ousted Ariadne Navarro. After all, a government with conservatives and Catholics, though without the right wing of the Franco party, would put Spain back to the situation on the eve of the proclamation of the Spanish Republic in 1931. The only difference would be that King Juan Carlos does assume the new throne, in contrast to his grandfather, who was not, to negotiate with the opposition in order to avoid the rise of a republican sentiment on the left. It is clear anyway that the democratic opposition will be excluded from a direct say in government program. At most, the new cabinet will negotiate with them to avoid a strong opposition from the trade unions and the political parties. These negotiations would cover the freedom for trade unions and the new electoral system, for which new law has to be drawn up. Essentially, it all depends upon whether the conservatives are prepared to give up sufficient privileges to make it acceptable for the elected parties to participate in this political system. This is Robert Bosshat for Radio Nederland in Barcelona.
And with that report, we've come to the end of this edition of Radio Nederland News Block. You are tuned to the Dutch World Broadcasting System, Radio Nederland, in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay broadcast via Bonaire, Netherlands, and Philippines.